So let's talk about music. My name is Sergio Barrer, and this is the first podcast of the second season of Let's Talk About Music. I am a composer and a pianist, and today I have with me the second guest I had for my first season and the first guest for this season, a good friend and a very good composer that I admire very much, which I can tell you is a good example of what a contemporary classical music composer is like, Dr. Bernardo Feldman. Hi, Bernardo.
How you doing, Sergio? Good being here again.
Yes, it's very nice to have you here. Bernardo and I met in Mexico many, many, many moons ago, and we have kept a good friendship. Now, I asked you to send me some pieces, and you did. The first one we're going to go over is called A Hierro Forjado, which is kind of cast iron, the translation.
Correct.
You wrote it in 1988?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. This is really a very good example of contemporary classical music writing. It forces you to open your mind. Do you have the notes that you put on the program available to you?
Yes, I do. I need to, if you give me a couple of seconds, I will put it in front of me.
Okay.
Yes.
The reason I'm asking is because I would like you to read the notes, because if you don't read the notes, it's harder to get into this music. It's more abstract than what we are used to. It doesn't really have a melody it's actually a guided improvisation from what I see.
That's right? Exactly right. Yeah. So what I'm going to do, if you allow me, is read the program notes that I came up with to describe the mood that I was after. And then I will explain briefly, adding to what he just said, how the score looks like. There's two versions so far that have been done. One is originally the one that I wrote for actually Manuel Enriquez, that was done by Robin Lawrence at UCLA. That was for violin and electronics. And then for Aaron Poland, I wrote a second version for French horn and electronics. Again, the same exact set of electronics. So if you want to call it the background to the live performer. So the program notes read like this: the densely layered sonic tapestry that constitutes the electronic component of cast iron or hierro forjado attempts to conjure the abrupt and crude aspects of urban life. At first sight, people crossing through our paths seem to have lost any sign of individuality. Only after we pause and allow ourselves to feel, we will realize who they really are. And the way the scores are written, it's kind of like a Calder mobile in which you have different pieces, in this case, different music gestures that can be moved around freely by the performer, meaning as he or she listens to the electronic portion of the piece, he or she has a menu of musical items through several pages to choose from. If the performer wants to improvise and disregard momentarily or permanently those instructions, he or she is able to do that. When I spoke with Robin Lawrence about that set of instructions or that score, she was very grateful to know that she could always fall back on them, and yet she didn't feel tied to them. And what for me was very beautiful from the approach that she took to the performance of the piece is that she was really tuned into the background. The piece starts in a very dramatic way, in a very, as you say, foreboding mood somewhat, but it walks itself, its trajectory takes you to a place of peace, of light, of hope. So she was tuning into those things, and her performance was going as a good concerto would have, in accordance to that, sometimes having a dialogue that would be in accord with what was happening next or along with her performance, with her ideas, and sometimes in contradiction with, which created very interesting music.
I have a question. I was following the score and I thought she didn't use all the elements, right? She used some of them.
Correct. And this is interesting too. I did not prescribe what should or should not be used. And she performed Robin Lawrence, the piece, several times. And each time she chose to focus on only some of them, which gives the piece a very strong sense of unity. And for me, it was fascinating because this is, again, a collaborative effort between a performer and a composer. When Erin Poland did the French horn version, she came up with different ideas and the results are drastically different from the French horn version.
Let's hear it then.
Okay.
Thank you.
Wow. All right. You know, it's the second time I hear it today. I hear the piece today. And the second time was a totally different experience than the first one.
Wonderful.
Yeah. First of all, the use of the horn. If you don't tell someone that there was a horn there, maybe they wouldn't have guessed.
Right. You know? That's part of the idea that I wanted to bridge the gap between an acoustic instrument and some vocal sounds and things of the sort and the electronic environment. You know, I didn't want it to be a fracture between the two of them. So yeah, the French horn is behaving like an electronic music instrument, so to speak.
Yeah, it's amazing. I just heard that now and I said, that's the French horn. Yeah, and that's the horn too. And it's part of the acoustic.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not, all the effects are done by asking it for extended techniques to be performed by the player. There are no manipulations done to the French horn. So it's not like it's a processed instrument. The processing happens to everything else, but not the French horn. If you look at the score, you will see that there's all kinds of effects in this page that allows the player to travel freely. One talks about a lip pressure glissando or glissandi, plural, ultra low tones, and the specific instructions ask stick mouthpiece completely inside the mouth while blowing softly into the instrument, force the inside cheek to act as a resonating membrane. Change valves to alter pitches. Dynamic levels should tend toward mezzo piano with a fluttering effect resembling small motorcycle engine.
And wow. That's I've never heard an instruction for a French horn say, hey, you should sound like a small motorcycle engine here.
Right. You know? Yeah. And I also add some adjectives, perhaps. And next to each one of those gestures, I suggest an emotion. So this one says dark and dirty. So what does that mean? Well, it depends on how the player interprets them. Another one says enigmas unsolved. Another gesture somewhere else says messages conflicted. Or childish and playful, as it from afar. So it's not just the notes that are there, but it's also a suggestion as to what the emotion is that is to be conveyed.
I love the instruction about vocalize a melody using a made-up language. I heard that. I heard the made-up language. And it's so funny because some people might strain to hear what he's saying, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Try to find some
meaning.
Some meanings, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, but there is no meaning there. The notation is very colorful for that. Anyway, it's a great example of very nicely done electronic and acoustic music at the same time. Usually I'm used to having this instrument that is playing kind of a melody or something, and then there is a background and you can go with the melody or go with the background, but you have two things going on, and this isn't that.
No,
it's one thing.
Very organic, fully integrated, the both elements, absolutely, yes.
Yeah, I think, you know, to my listeners, you have to open yourself up for these things, because if the expectations are the same as in a normal piece of music, it doesn't work. You have to come here with the idea of, okay, this composer is trying to do something new. But you see, I'm starting to see where the difference is between good electronic acoustic music and not so good electronic acoustic music. This is one piece of music, and it is well thought out, and the whole thing. And you got a good performer for it. You got a guy that really got it.
Well, Erin, a girl.
A girl, sorry.
Yeah, but I'll tell you quickly a story. After we performed the piece, and she had practiced it and assisted me in the ideas and tried all the gestures. She was about to be accepted at CalArts, and she needed to audition. So I said, well, why don't we drive from College of Ekenich, which is right around the corner. We'll bring our own speakers and our own equipment. And we actually, to make the story short, parked ourselves right side of the office of the faculty member for whom she was to audition. And basically right as the things, meaning the speakers and the amplifier and everything, barely fitted into this professor's room, she played the piece for the first time. That was, I think, the premiere of the piece. And she got accepted at CalArts, which to me is a wonderful story.
Yes, it is. That's, yeah. And that's the right place to play this, you know, to audition with this.
Absolutely. You know?
That's great. All right, now let's try something completely different. You sent me a song, a jazzy song, actually. Right. What's the story of this song? This is a newer piece, right?
Are you referring to How Is It That?
Yes, exactly. Well, then.
Interestingly enough, this is a piece that I wrote many years ago. I can't even tell you how far back, but about a decade at least. Uh-huh. And I came up with words that I didn't quite understand at the time. How is it that when I walk alone, no one follows me, no shade follows me, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a part, I guess you could call it the verse or something, that I repeat, you know, I don't really need you. Oh, the next time around it says, you know, I don't really miss you. And as I wrote those lyrics or those words, I didn't feel that I was talking specifically about anyone. They were not charged with anger or hatred. I didn't quite understand what I was writing. And now, I don't know if it's 15, 20 years later, I was taking a bicycle ride on the beach near where I live. And the song was hovering in my head. And those words came to me as I finally actually put the bicycle in the sand and I laid down staring at the sky and the sun and the waves in the background. And the words came, you know, I don't really miss you. You know, I don't really need you. And to me, if I may get into psychology a little bit, it was this sense of being a complete human being myself, as opposed to having dependency on people or things. And it was very peaceful place. And I said, that's very interesting that so many years later, I understand what I wrote. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I was just thinking about lyrics in that sense in general. There is something to be said for lyrics that are not totally clear about the meaning, that leave the listener to put some of the meaning himself. I think, you know, the Bohemian Rhapsody, nobody ever understands that, or a horse with no name. You know, these songs that are, what did he say? I don't know, but it's interesting.
Yeah, well, you're touching on the several things that are interesting. In this case, I'll repeat basically myself. The composer himself, or quote unquote, poet, didn't even know what he was writing. That was me. And the other thing that to me is interesting, Sergio, is that I was thinking about the fact that a lot of my music, one way or another, to different degrees, is very much like many composers of my generation and younger composers, informed by pop music and rock music. Even the previous piece that we heard, there's I could blame the Beatles, but I could also blame Stockhausen for the things that are happening there. But Bohemian Rhapsody is it an opera? Is it a pop music? It's we're redefining music as we go along, I think.
Right, and this is a very jazzy language. Do you use that language often, or?
I love jazz. I'm not a trained jazz musician, mm-hmm. and yet I feel very comfortable, and I think I understand it very well in my own way, and I'm very proud of it. I'm very happy about the results. Of course, I know about harmony in the jazz world and how they're used, or sometimes they're just extensions of traditional harmony, or in very progressive jazz, they're not. But I find that knowing enough about the language and not be fully immersed allows me to be in this very unique place where I can come up with something that's of my own.
Got it. Yeah. And you also leave the performer a chance to go on his own, like you did on the other, not so much because this person has notes more or less to follow, but they can put, ornaments or extend notes or, there is freedom for the performer, right?
Which again, yeah, it became a tradition in the late 20th century from composers that left a lot of indeterminacy built into the music. But it's also part of pop music, of course. When, go to a concert of a band that you know, oftentimes you surprise yourself, well, wait a minute, that's not how it sounds in the record or the streaming, if we talk about the way things are done today. I will also say, and I am proud of this, this song was performed by my daughter, Kendall. She was a little girl, and that was Kendall Damashek, as she's being married. And the other interesting thing is the first part was recorded when I first wrote it, and then I had not finished the lyrics. So it took about 15, 20 years for her to record the second half, and I made a big effort so that nobody would notice that there's a difference in her, if I may so myself, wonderful performance. I am very proud and touched by the way Kendall sings this song.
Yeah. Okay, without further ado, let's listen to it.
How is it then when I close my eyes, it all seems clear? How is it then removed and afar I saw? Why is it that when I walk alone, no shade follows me? Stillness feels so deep. Earth beats with me. steal my spirit.
Very, very nice. That was very nice. You're right, the performance is magnificent. The throatiness sometimes of the voice and the, you know, all this emotion that goes into it. It's very well done. Congratulations.
Thank you. When I was recording it with Kendall, she recognized that even though it's written down, it is meant to be improvisatory. You know, it's kind of an improvisation. And I'm very lucky that, you know, singers of her generation, and to be specific, her, is able to find this long note that I write and bend it and find beautiful things to do with those notes. So
yeah.
It's wonderful. And this comes from pop tradition, of course, you know, and popular folk musicians are very comfortable doing that. And it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, it's and there is an air of mystery to this piece. As the lyrics are kind of not really totally self-explanatory,
right?
It adds that element too.
I tried to add again a lot of electronic, very ethereal sounds, and I wanted to make this a very ethereal piece. And after a lot of work and trial and error, I decided that the most beautiful thing I could do to the piece is let Kendall's voice shine in a very sparse piano. Nothing was better than this simple version. So I said, you know, leave it alone. That's what the piece wants. That's where it ends.
Yeah, there is a certain courage needed to do simple things.
And I know.
There is, because somebody might look at it. I remember on a piece I delivered to a cantor, I put the same chord about 12 times before they moved into something else. I said, what are you doing? What are you doing 12 chords like that for? And I said, you know, Stravinsky did like 70 times in the Petrushka score. So. Yeah.
Right.
But you have to come with something like that, or they say, this guy doesn't know anything.
Yeah, and it's kind of strange to have to justify oneself falling in the backs of a great composer such as Stravinsky. To me, it's at some point very early in the process, it's the piece that starts to talk to us like a child and ask us what it wants. And if your piece needed 12 repetitions of the chord, you're just listening to it. Obeying.
Yeah, definitely. I remember the person that another composer, and the name escapes me because I haven't heard too much of him, said, you have to trust the music, you know?
Yeah.
That's it. The music is doing it. It's speaking to you. You just let it speak and you have to trust it.
Yeah, we human beings, you know, composers, we're not this privileged higher level people, whatever that means. We're human beings like anybody else, but we hopefully have learned to trust intuition and let our intellect wait a little bit longer until we start to shape the composition. It's not that we throw it away or throw it out the window, but when somebody asks, how did you do this piece? And we answer, well, it came to me. Really what we're saying is we're allowing intuition to be active. And I think this is something that in our civilization, perhaps we are afraid of. If it doesn't have a logical explanation, if it doesn't come from the intellect, I mean, even as composers, I remember many times when I've said to myself, oh, come on, this was an accident, what you just came up with. So you need to prove that you're so smart that it came from your mind. Until I said, you know what? It didn't come from anybody else. I learned, it's my own intuition. And if it comes from the gods or however you want to call it, let it be. That's okay.
Yeah. I I know exactly what you mean. I was writing this oratorio, which I just finished about, and it was a movement about the pioneers that settled Israel. And I said, this has to be like this. And I wanted to end like this. And the ending has to be like this. And I wrote notes and everything, but I wasn't hearing it. And then I started really putting it down, and it ended up being something because, yeah. You know, you can only impose so much on the music. You sing, oh, this, I want a big finale here and everything. And then it starts coming to you, and then it starts taking its own shape, and you say, okay, I give up, you win. It stays like this. Otherwise it feels artificial or something.
When you write that big finale, you realize that that's not working. So let me listen to what the piece wants.
No, it just, when I listened to that, said, no, it's not. When was the last part that was really working and went back there?
Right.
Wrote the last 2 minutes again, because it just wasn't that, the piece wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting thing that happens with compositions, you know? Anyway, this was a totally different than the other thing. And yet it's another work that it's its own universe.
Yeah. I think that, at least for myself, it's a very cheap metaphor or analogy or something. It's like I have a switch and I say, okay, today I'm going to be more pop oriented. Today I'm going to explore, and the old sides of me, a very deep, profound, enigmatic side of myself. And I know that some of this is going to be more palatable to some audiences and some others are not. And I'm okay with that. I'm just expressing different sides of my persona.
Right. I want to ask you a question. This happened to me recently. Do you ever get discouraged as a composer by some music you hear written by some other people? It happened to me. I heard this piece on the internet that it sounded like it was different. It sounded something, but there was something that I couldn't connect to it. And kind of discouraged me somehow of writing music. But does it happen to you at all, or is it just me?
If I'm understanding correctly, one of the issues that we have as artists is that we convey a message, we deliver a message, but there's no guarantee that there's going to be a receiver on the other end. We try to communicate, but is there somebody on the other side on the receiving end? And that is, that's an important question. And there are many things that come into play that may be extra musical. Some of them may be open-mindedness. Some of that may be, if people have accepted something, you know, I can think of Vincent van Gogh. When I was little, I didn't understand why people were making such a big fuss out of his art. And maybe partially was because if one person says he's great, then the next one will, and so on and so forth. I had to become more of a mature person to realize, oh my God, I can't believe that, well, this brush strokes, you can see who this person is that he's painting. And, but you know, this is somebody that now a painting of his is valued on the millions of dollars. And when he was alive, he was barely able to sell one single painting. Are we writing for people to consume our work? Are we writing for posterity? Are we writing for ourselves? All of those can have positive answers. I know that the song that we just heard is way more palatable to a majority of people than the first one that we heard, that actually you have to explain that we have to have open ears. And is it discouraging? I think we have to stick to who we are and what we want. And yes, be aware of that, the burden of finding open hearts and open ears.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, that's a nice answer. All right, the last thing we're gonna hear of yours is a choral piece. It is a piece that you wrote for Cantare, a program that is in Minneapolis, right?
Correct. Yeah, this is a program that is part of the Cantare group by Philip Brunel. And Philip Schultz is actually the person that was, both of them, wonderful musicians, composers, conductors. And the idea there is, as you know, to bring the culture of Mexico into Minneapolis, which is fantastic. You know, it's not even California, which is where right. I live, and we're right next to Mexico, you know, the Tijuana, Ensenada, and et cetera. But what was interesting and very touching, I came in, this was a residency that happened three times. I had to go there and meet with several choirs. And this one was in Rosemount. And I told the students, please suggest what you would like us to work on, because this is not going to be my piece. This is our composition. And what happened is that a student sent me an email, and he said that there was this student that passed away just shortly before I was visiting, and she was a poet. And I'll tell you the name after we hear the piece, because I want to make sure that I pronounce it correctly. But she's writing about this young woman that unfortunately passed away in a car accident, how she would like to be like a flower amongst the wild, the brushes and so on and so forth, and be a good example of good things and bring joy to people and so on and so forth. So I had no doubt that this time the lyrics were going to come from her. When I ran it by both Phillips, you know, Schultz and Brunel, they said, yes, the only requirement is that it's got to be in Spanish, because this is Cantare, and this is to feature the music from Mexico. And by the way, I was there with Jimena Contreras, fantastic young composer, who was also participating with younger choirs. I was working with high school choirs. At any rate, when the piece was presented to the choir, they did a marvelous job. And the conductor, Steve, and again, I want to make sure that I pronounce his name right, so I'm going to tell it to you after we play the piece to make sure that I do it right. Being from Mexico, I want to make sure that I don't mispronounce like we tend to when we speak a foreign language. And anyways, he was a marvelous conductor. I could not believe the things that he was extracting out of a choir, the motivation that these kids had. And of course, they were singing to their friend that was no longer there. And the day of the performance, mom and dad and the brother were there, and we were all crying together as we heard this piece.
Well, I can see how that would happen. All right, we're gonna hear it. Thank you. There was some sadness intrinsic in the piece, I guess.
Absolutely, yeah.
After you told me the story, I could feel it more than when I saw it without any context.
Yeah, no, it absolutely. I mean, this is somebody that wanted to be the light for everybody, and she's no longer in a material form with us anymore. Her name is Joan Razel Yambing. And the original lyrics in English come from her collection of poems through the teenage years. And the conductor is Stephen Albaugh. And I apologize if I'm not pronouncing it perfectly well.
Right. Well, this is a very moving piece. I was looking at the harmonic language that you use. It's not traditional. It's very, you use other. How do you come up with the harmonic language for this?
This may sound very simplistic. I use my ear. When I was studying music at the conservatory in Mexico City, Jesús Villaseñor, my counterpoint teacher, and I remember if he was also my chromatic harmony teacher, he gave us an exercise where we were to choose four notes, whatever notes sounded good to our ears, and we played a game. And he did not invade this game, by the way. This goes back to Europe. The late romantic composers. And the game consisted of moving any one note, one, two, three, or all four notes by half step to the neighboring note above or below. And when we found that the next chord sounded good following the previous one, we would write it down. And the game continued. You know, you wrote as many chords as you liked. You never questioned if this was a C major seven or a whatever, G flat minor with a suspended this or that. It was just what the ear dictated. And my exercises at that time for that class sounded like a Wagnerian music, you know, very much like Tristan and Isolde, the prelude and the quality of the chords. And I thought between, let's pretend, Monday and Wednesday when I did the homework and it was to be presented in front of the class, that everybody's music was going to sound just like mine, generally speaking. In other words, very romantic.
Right.
A lot of chromaticism, a lot of moving in a way that Wagner would have. And then, of course, you analyze and you figure out what you wrote and how you named that chord and so on and so forth. But to my surprise was that each student's music sounded completely different because of, once again, their intuition took them to different places. So there was one that was so jazzy and the other one was so this and so that. And I was marveled by that. And all those things kind of gave me permission over time to do, come up with my own language. Another thing that I recall just as we speak, somebody wanted it implied the reduction of Ravel's Bolero for piano. Okay. And I'm sure somebody had done it, but the point is that I was working on it. And as I'm working on the piece, I realized that Ravel, brilliant as he was, his harmonization of the piece, every time the bolero repeats, I'm sure most of us listeners know that this is a very repetitive, minimalistic piece that goes several times with a big buildup, orchestrally speaking, but also harmonically, he ends up with what we call clusters. And I could not believe that there was just some of those things could be played with the elbows or the hand on top of the strings. And it sounds, as we all know, wonderfully. So again, I analyze some of it. I realize that some of it is extensions of very simple chords, but some other stuff I don't even bother analyzing. I just trust my ear.
Right.
I also had the fortune at some point and on the other end of the spectrum to be John Cage's assistant as he was celebrating his 75th anniversary here in California. And I studied a lot of his music and also gave me the confidence of, you know, if this is what you hear, if this is what you're, he has a very different approach than I do to music, but he's like Laurie Anderson says, a composer, violinist, singer, he gave us permission to explore many things. I don't know how much the Beatles took directly from him and previous composers, but, you know, in their albums. And I'm mentioning all of those because those influences, because again, my music comes from all those places. So another thing that I did with this piece, by the way, I was so insecure about how it was going to sound on the choir with those, if you want to call them dissonances or distant harmonics, that I actually recorded with my own voice the beginning of it to see how it would sound with all those, I don't want to call them clashes, those
seconds that you have.
Yeah, unusual to some degree harmonies from a most traditional point of view. Jazz musicians would say, what do you talk about? There's nothing unorthodox about that. I would agree, of course. So that's how this harmonization came about. Of course, for a choir, you have to write it in such a manner that melodically each one of the lines, you know it better than I do, can be sung without much effort. They have to be very naturally leading from one place to the other. Otherwise, it would be very hard for a choir to perform this. And I have so much respect for the students at Rosemont High School because they did a fantastic job.
Yes. And they put in the time. I bet that they had to put in the time to really get it right, because it's just a matter of how many time some people are willing to put into things.
Yeah, and we're not always that lucky. Yeah.
Yes, so that was very nice. I enjoyed it, and I think I had some other things to say, but I think you have said them very well. Whatever I was going to say, I was very enthralled by what you were saying. So I think this is a very good point to end this podcast. I want to thank you very much for coming and for sharing with me all your ideas and your music. And we'll have to do it again sometime.
Okay? Absolutely. It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me, Sergio.
You're very welcome. And that's all, folks.